Our guest tonight, today, is Jeff Adams, who lives in Newton, Massachusetts, and has made this remarkable film that I saw years ago come back into my consciousness again. And excited, the film is called Something's Gotta Be Arranged. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, great. So happy to be here to talk to you about this.
Well, I love the film on a lot of levels the first time I saw it, because as you know, I'm a blues fanatic, and had seen Paul Jeremiah play a couple times up close. You had mentioned the film to me years ago, and then to see it was just, it's just remarkable. So I want to talk more in detail about the film itself, but first, how did you come to make this film? When did you make it, and how did it come about?
Well, I made it as a student at Rhode Island School of Design.
RISD.
RISD, in Providence, Rhode Island, where I majored in film and video production.
Excellent.
And so the expectation is, in your senior year, you create a senior degree project.
Great.
And it should be a mini masterpiece of some kind.
Great.
And I tossed around a few ideas early on that year. There's a well-known tenor saxophone player, Harry Allen, who works in New York City now.
Okay.
But he was a teenager then.
Uh-huh.
And kind of a sensation. This is 1983.
83, okay.
And I thought, well, that would be fun.
Yeah.
To make a film about him. And I was acquainted with his music, and I just liked the idea of this young, clean-cut Rhode Island kid playing extremely amazing jazz tenor saxophone, which he's still doing now.
Cool.
So that was a possibility. And then, as you may know, I'm a big fan of Slim Gaylord.
Oh, Slim Gaylord.
And
Slim Gaylord,
he was still going strong.
Wow.
And I had seen him perform in 1981 at SUNY Purchase, the JVC Jazz Festival.
Oh, yeah. That was a big festival
back
then. Yeah,
and I thought, oh, wouldn't it be great to go to New York City, find Slim Gaylord, and just spend time with him and make a documentary about him. But I ruled that out because it would have required a lot of resources, which I did not have.
Uh-huh.
I couldn't travel to New York whenever I wanted to. I didn't have any money.
Right.
And I didn't have the time to get on the phone with a management company and, you know, work out the details. And so I didn't do that. But I knew Paul Jeremiah extremely well.
Oh, okay.
Because I had played with him.
Wow.
In a very weird situation that I'll explain to you.
Okay, yeah, I want to hear about that.
So I called him and I explained, I'm making this degree project. I want to make a documentary about a musician. And I thought you'd be a great subject. Well, sure, come on down. And
right.
It just happened.
Okay.
And it worked beautifully because he was so comfortable because he knew me.
Uh-huh.
And it worked out great.
Yeah, that's one of the things that comes across in the film right away is his comfort level doing whatever. Cooking breakfast.
Exactly.
Fixing the alternator.
Right.
Playing gigs.
Yep.
Traveling.
Yeah.
He seems completely comfortable in front of the camera.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's because we knew each other.
So how did you meet Paul Jeremiah?
That's a bit of a long story.
Let's
hear
it.
I'm going to compress it.
Okay, compress it. We have a compressor on our...
Okay. That won't help with this. So in high school, we had a little traditional New Orleans-style jazz band.
In high school?
High school. Some people might call it a Dixieland band.
Yeah.
Because I had a gang of friends. A guy was a clarinet player.
Uh-huh.
A guy was a trumpet player.
Uh-huh.
A guy was a trombone player. And I played tuba.
Uh-huh.
So
great.
You can see, there's the front line,
you're ready
and there's
go.
The tuba player. So all we need to do is get someone to play banjo, maybe someone to play piano, and someone to play drums.
Yep.
And our high school band leader, he's the one who said, oh, this looks like a Dixieland band. These three guys who are hanging out, that's the front line. So
cool.
He handed us books of Dixieland music.
Great.
Music on paper, in books, to play New Orleans jazz.
Great.
And we started with those books, but we very quickly said, we don't need these books. And just started to play New Orleans tunes. My father was a musician in a New Orleans jazz band, so I knew the music. And one summer, my high school band leader said, you know, you're a tuba and trombone player, but we need a baritone sax player in the stage band, the jazz band, next year. So why don't you take this baritone sax home?
Okay.
So I did, and I learned to play it. During that summer, the clarinet player and myself and the trombone player, who was learning banjo, formed a little trio.
Nice.
And we were busking on the street in Providence, Rhode Island.
Great.
And so the baritone sax was the bass instrument of the trio, and the banjo was the rhythm and the clarinet. and we all sang sometimes, and it was a great little thing. And since you have mentioned Bix Beiderbecke to me...
Oh, I love Bix.
You'll want to listen to Adrian Rollini, who was my role model for using the baritone sax as the bass instrument. He played bass saxophone in that great early Bix band,
gotcha.
Bix and his gang. Okay, all right, so cool. We had this band. And also my brother was the program director at a college radio station, WRIU, at University of Rhode Island. Still a great college station.
Great.
And they had a Sunday live music radio program, and he arranged for this little trio, which we called the Empire Jazz Bandits.
Nice, nice name. Empire Jazz Bandits. Great, good.
So we played this live show, and I got a call 2 days later. Paul Jeremiah had heard the show.
Okay.
And he liked the band. And he said, well, I want to get together.
So Paul himself calls you?
Paul called me.
Not his agent or something?
No.
Okay.
He said, I want to get together with you guys.
Great.
Because in addition to doing country blues, he was playing a lot of early jazz tunes. And he had an interest in early jazz and a record collection of a lot of early jazz. He loved that stuff. So he was excited. Hey, these kids are playing this music.
Wow.
So he called me. And he came over to my parents' house where we used to practice. And we played with him.
Cool.
And that blossomed into a little relationship where he got us gigs.
Wow, great.
So we would go, say, down in Newport where he lived, One Pelham East, and our little jazz trio would do a set. And then he would do his solo set, and then we'd do a set together.
Nice.
Where we played mostly old jazz tunes, but also some of his tunes that we joined him on. And that was our little routine.
Wow, that's great.
So that would have been about 1980, 81.
Oh, so that's how you knew him.
I knew him from that situation.
Gotcha. Great. Yeah. Great. That's part of the reason the film, like the comfort we're getting at, is you're a fellow musician.
Exactly.
You've done gigs with him.
I did.
So you have that comfort level.
And we had a lot of fun joking. And I remember one time we were riding in the car and he said, you know, there's a lot of Groucho Marx in you. That's the ultimate compliment.
I can't think of a higher one.
I know. So we got along great. And we did these gigs. And, a little side note, we did a gig at the Sunnyside Cafe in Narragansett, Rhode Island.
Okay.
Long gone. Little restaurant cafe. Uh-huh. Doing the same three-set deal I just explained. And when we got to the gig, we're playing. He said, oh, yeah, a friend of mine's going to stop in and check us out. Maybe sit in and play a couple of tunes.
Okay.
And the friend was Leon Redbone.
Oh, my gosh.
He was a friend of Paul's. And he was on his way to Portland, Maine or something. And he stopped in and played with us. And so did I bring my reel-to-reel tape recorder that night? No.
Wow, that's fabulous. Because Paul is such an amazing guitar player. And he comes from this, I think they were that East Coast community that soaked in what Gary Davis was doing. And then all of these other guys, these East Coast guys, Blind Blake, the guys down in Georgia. One of the things that really surprises me in the film is the twist where suddenly we meet Blind John Davis.
Right.
And that was just amazing. I guess he explains it in the film. Yeah, so how did the Blind John Davis connection come about?
Well, it's almost exactly what you see in the film.
Okay.
Is Paul just said, you know, I could call Blind John Davis and maybe I could go and play with him.
Okay.
In Chicago. And I said, well, that sounds great. And that would make a good finale to the film to see you guys playing together.
It does. It does.
And so it just made sense. This is going to be the payoff at the end. After you've seen Paul perform solo and talk about his life a little bit.
Yeah.
That he's going to perform with one of the old guys.
Yeah.
And the ultimate message being, you know, I'm the new generation and they're passing on the blues to us and we're going to pass it on to somebody else.
Yeah.
So it just made sense.
Wow.
And so he drove to Chicago because he drove his car.
The car all over the country. The Dodge Dart.
The Dodge Dart. He drove all over the country, had gigs everywhere in the Midwest and everywhere. And he had a gig in Chicago. And at the time, I was still a student at Rhode Island School of Design in my senior year. But I had a part-time job that had been a summer job previously that I got through the RISD work study. And it was at a medical company, and I was shooting video for this company.
Oh.
And there was some conference or something going on or surgery I had to shoot or something, and it was in the Midwest, and I convinced the company to also fly me to Chicago.
Nice.
So I could film for my degree project.
Oh, perfect.
But Jason, the equipment I was carrying,
yeah, what
you have to understand, You know, if we were doing it now, when I could pack it all into a tiny case.
Yeah, right, right.
What'd you carry? At the time, I had an Arriflex Sync Sound 16 millimeter camera, which is blimped, which means it's silenced so that the motor can't be heard.
Uh-huh.
So it's got a lot of sound insulation.
Oh,
fairly large, heavy thing with a big magazine that holds 400-foot reels of film.
Whoa.
That and its lens, which is a big, giant lens. The lens was as big as our cameras are, a video camera is now.
Uh-huh.
So that, a light kit and a big box.
Uh-huh.
Sound gear, which at that time, luckily, was not a reel-to-reel Nagra.
I remember the Nagras from the old days.
It was a Sony cassette that was adapted to do sync sound for 16-millimeter production. So that was a little bit small.
Okay.
Microphone, mic stand.
Wow.
And then I had to bring all my video equipment for this other gig.
Oh, right. For the...
So I had two packages of motion picture-making equipment by myself.
Wow.
Lugging on airplanes.
Okay, great.
I would never do that now.
Yeah, it's a lot of gear. So the film was shot... Tell us what... So the film was shot on 16-millimeter.
16-millimeter reversal film.
Okay.
As opposed to negative film, which means when it goes to the lab,
uh-huh.
the film that was in the camera gets processed and comes back to you as a positive.
Oh, okay. So we're not producing a negative and...
Right. You strike a work print from the positive.
Uh-huh.
And you work on that, and then you make a final print.
I just think the tonal quality is so beautiful in the film. The outdoor shots with the working on the alternator and driving around. So what town are you driving around in there?
That's Newport and Middletown, Rhode Island.
Middletown.
He lived in Newport.
Okay.
And actually, it's not apparent if you look at the film, but he was living in two different houses. He moved in the course of the making of the film.
Oh, I did not catch that.
Yeah, okay. So there's two locations.
Okay.
It doesn't matter.
Right.
He lived in a little house in Newport is all.
Okay, great.
Is what comes through, and that's where he was.
Okay. The outdoor shots have a wonderful light quality, I think. Just amazing. And I particularly enjoy there's a couple good camera angles on the alternator part. Two shots from below, I think.
Yeah, looking up at the hood.
It's a nice space.
You.
And we get a sense of his life being a kind of the musical life that he chose and worked on for himself.
And I like to, it's a film made in 1983, but it looks like it was made in 1963.
It has that feel. I mean, that's one of the things that leaps out at me. It reminds me of the early, field.
Yeah, it has that.
It has that field quality.
Like
but
an
it's,
archival.
Yeah, archival feel to it, except it's beautifully edited.
Thank you.
Yeah, the editing is beautiful. And the sound is beautiful as well.
All recorded on that little Sony cassette.
That's cool. Even like coming out of Paul's record player is what it looked like, some of it. I mean, that was the effect. We were in his living room listening to records.
Listening to records. Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, it was recorded through speakers, so it would sound that way.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's really cool. Yeah. So real quick. So you make your way to Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily, blind John Davis is still there and still alive. He died in 1985, two years later, was shot.
Yeah,
he was born in 1913. And for people who don't know, blind John Davis was part of this pre-Muddy Waters Chicago-era blues where he played a lot with Tampa Red and Big Bill Brunzi and the first Sonny Boy Williamson. A lot of these guys were on the Bluebird label.
Did you mention that he played the piano?
Yeah. Oh, I forgot. We didn't say that, did we? Hopefully you'll see the film. He's a phenomenal piano player and has some great boogie-woogie pieces under his own name.
Oh, yeah.
And then phenomenal piano player. And it is a touching moment where he and Paul are kind of talking and John Davis is talking about what the blues is to him and whether or not white people, how they fit into it or not, I think is really interesting. And Paul's right there. And they do one of my favorite songs, Don't You Lie to Me. I love that song. Yeah. I think of it as a Tampa Red song.
Yeah.
A couple other film details I want to talk about. I'm way interested in film and blues, so this hits a perfect intersection for me.
Great.
But the shot of the toast that he throws out is also a great shot. He's apparently kind of chronically burning the toast, I kind of gather. Was that?
Well, he's making his breakfast.
Yeah.
And he's talking to me while I'm filming him make breakfast. And he's telling me anecdotes. And while he's doing that, he had put the toast in, and then he realizes the toast is burning.
Yeah, right, right.
And he throws it out. Side.
Yeah, yeah, but then you grab a quick shot of the
Yeah, you see it laying on the ground.
On the ground.
Well, you have to see that.
Yeah, to finish the narrative arc of him throwing the toast out.
It doesn't matter now because you won't see it, but when I edited the film, it was on film. You have to chop up the...
Cut it
together, make an A roll and a B roll, and it gets sent to the printer. And I did that, and you're using cement and a splicer to put bits of 60 millimeter film together.
Wow.
And I put the toast shot upside down.
Oh, really?
And I couldn't tell working on a light table because there was no perspective in the shot.
Right, there's
I couldn't
not
tell
like
it's upside
a telephone
down.
Pole we could see or something.
Yeah, there's nothing indicating because you're looking straight down at the ground.
Yeah, yeah.
But then when you see the film projected, oh no.
Oh.
That's upside down because you could see the toast, the perspective is not quite right.
Oh, I'll have to look closely at that.
Anymore. I fixed it.
Oh, you fixed it.
Yeah, so when we got into the digital age,
okay,
and I got a new transfer of the film done to make the DVD.
Okay, yeah, you sent me a DVD.
Right,
which
you have that DVD.
Yeah, I love that.
And then that's the transfer that the YouTube video is made from. I flipped it.
Oh, that's wonderful.
To finally fix that mistake.
So were other people working with you on this
film?
Yeah,
a crew of other students. That was the deal. In fact, the department is still that way. You wear all the hats.
Great.
And then you crew for each other.
Gotcha.
So when I went to Chicago, I was by myself. Uh-huh. But for the rest of the film, I always had a sound person and an assistant working with me.
Wow. Amazing. And did you, so this was your final project for RISD, right? Now, I want to talk for a second about other aspects of your career, because you then went on to you've had a long, successful career in film and television. I know you've done a lot of work with PBS and its spinoffs over the years. Could you describe a little bit of that?
Yeah. So after the film,
I
didn't spend much more time doing any personal projects just because of the pressure to make a living.
Yeah.
So I worked for this medical company making videos for their marketing department for another couple of years. And then decided, I'm going to go freelance and just do my own thing. And at that time in Providence, it was wide open. There wasn't anybody who was like a, you know, jack of all trades film and video maker running a business.
I see.
So there was a great opportunity there.
I see.
So I started doing that. And through playing music, I knew musicians who knew people at ad agencies. And I want you to meet this guy. And so slowly I developed this freelance business in production, directing TV spots for ad agencies, doing industrial films, doing work for nonprofits. You know, work. Work.
Yeah.
And playing music on the side in various situations. And I did that for a long time. I went to Nashville and directed music videos through...
You directed... Wow, right.
Through an odd connection. Do you know Cheryl Wheeler?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I did a music video for Cheryl.
Oh, wow. And this must have been in the height of the music video era.
It was. It was the 80s. Early 90s.
Early 90s, okay.
And she got a contract with Capitol Nashville.
Wow, that's a big deal.
And she had a manager in Providence. And she wanted to bring her own director down.
Okay.
And Cheryl is wild. She's got a great sense of humor, and she's a brilliant songwriter and performer.
Yeah, I've heard her CDs.
She's just fantastic. So I met her, and we really hit it off.
Great.
And so she took me to Nashville as her director. I'd never directed a music video before.
Really? Yeah.
But I knew the stuff.
Yeah,
I knew. Yeah, I knew how to do run a location shoot and organize things and find stuff, and and most importantly, I could edit. So
I see.
I could direct and edit.
I see. That gets back to this jack of all trades that you had coming out of RISD and that you developed in the earlier stuff.
Yeah.
So you could turn those skills and attentions toward a music video.
Yeah. Okay. So that was just a fun diversion.
Yeah.
I mean,
cool.
I could have pursued that, and there was a connection I made there that I could have pursued, but I didn't. I went back to Providence and continued doing my stuff. And then. Because I did commercials, at some point in the mid-90s, somebody said, oh yes, this WGBH wants to do mock TV commercials for a mock product to help kids. Let's see if I can remember the example.
Okay.
Like a detergent with Ask It All.
Okay.
And it was funny commercials like iconic TV commercials.
Like the classics,
but they were basically telling kids, you don't need this product.
Oh.
You can do it for yourself.
Oh,
so there's a shampoo commercial, and there's a commercial. They look like TV commercials for fictional products.
Interesting.
They wanted the person who did TV commercials to do it.
Yeah, so, and you had the
I was recommended. Yeah. I went up there, and I did those, working for them. And then subsequently, other little things came from them, and they said, what about that guy who did those commercials? Let's call him. So I got a foot in the door there, and I had done a lot of work for ad agencies. I worked as an assistant director on a feature film.
Oh.
I found that extremely stressful, and I realized I don't want to do any more of that.
Uh-huh.
And this work of doing short segments involving kids at WGBH suited me to a T. So I've been doing that exclusively since around 1998 or so.
Right. And so
that's
including
it.
Shows like, wow, since 1998, that...
Yeah.
So
there are
years,
several animated
years.
Shows that they're animated.
Yeah, like Arthur is one.
Arthur was an early example.
Yeah.
And Arthur has a live-action interstitial segment attached to the animation.
And now a word from...
And now a word from his kids.
From us kids,
yeah,
right.
So
now
I pitched that to them
in
1998. Six, and they bought my idea, and I've been making those segments ever since.
Wow, that is fantastic.
But then that kind of segment for all kinds of shows, Curious George and Martha Speaks and PBS animated shows that are produced at WGBH.
I see. That's
so that's all I do now.
One thing I saw, Paul, when I glimpsed Paul in the one of the performance segments, I think he's playing at the Last Call Saloon.
That's correct.
And that is a place I used to play. The
brief
time I lived in Providence,
right.
I was immersed in this blues scene. That's when I saw Paul a couple times.
Yep.
So, but you were playing music as well in the Providence scene. What did you play and who'd you play with
Well,
at
first,
that time?
When I was at RISD, I met Gail Greenwood. Gail and I were a couple for a short time.
Uh-huh.
And we were in a band together called The Dames.
The Dames.
We won the WBRU Rock Hunt in 1986.
Okay.
And then, as happened with every other Rock Hunt winner, we broke up shortly thereafter.
It's almost written into the script, I think.
And it was an all-girl band with two guys in it.
Nice.
And I played tenor, mostly.
Okay.
Tenor sax. And so I got to know Gail, and she connected me with ad agencies because she was an illustrator.
Ah.
And just as a side, Gail is now the bass player with Belly.
Belly.
Yeah.
Okay, excellent.
Which was big in the 90s, and now they're back touring.
Oh, great.
Gail's completely amazing. And she helped me on the film.
Oh, she did? How'd she help?
She was a student at RISD.
Oh.
And she was an assistant. She took me places. She drove me places.
Okay.
She lugged equipment around.
Great.
She was terrific.
Fantastic.
And still terrific. So we had this band, The Dames, for about 5 years or so.
Cool.
And then the oddest thing was, I'm not sure if you remember the Big Nozzo Puppet Theater.
I remember that. They were ongoing when I got to Providence.
That's Erminio Pinkway, and he and I went to RISD.
Ah.
And his puppet performance.
Yeah, describe that.
Oh, puppet there, it's giant foam puppets.
Yeah.
Google it.
Yeah, okay, Google it.
And he always had a blues band.
Uh-huh.
And we wore puppet heads.
Yes.
And the two things a musician really wants to be able to do, you can't do in a puppet head. That's see and hear.
So true.
It's very challenging, but a lot of Providence musicians played in his bands.
I
Everybody,
remember that. Yeah.
We always thought there should be a reunion.
Yeah, there should be.
Of all the musicians who ever played for Erminio. There's thousands of people.
Yeah.
So I did that. And then there's a wonderful arts organization in Providence called AS220.
Right, which had a performance space.
Performance space now. They own four buildings. It's a beautiful thing. And so I hooked up with musicians there, and there was a group called the Smokin' Jackets, a little blues band.
Ah, nice.
With a Professor Longhair-style pianist.
Oh, nice.
I played saxophone with them for a while. And then there was a house funk band at AS220 called the Neo-90s Dance Band.
Cool.
And I was in the horn section for that.
Cool.
And
you're still playing today.
Yeah, now I'm playing in an activist street brass band that's based in Somerville, Massachusetts, called the Second Line Social Aid and Pleasure Society Brass Band.
Great name.
And that band started the Honk Festival in Somerville in 2006.
Which is a nationally known...
It's grown into a movement.
Big thing,
it's
yeah.
It's a honk.
Honk,
it's
yeah.
Honk West, Honk Texas.
Ah!
There's Pronk in Providence.
Okay, great.
There's Bronk in Brooklyn.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, cool.
And other festivals around the world where these activist street bands get together and make noise.
Yeah, we have...
So I do that.
Yeah, we have... In Bloomington, we have the Jefferson Street Parade,
yeah,
which kind of touches on that a little bit.
Yeah.
It's exciting for me to see music performed... you know, publicly and on the street, and it's something that people did before recorded music.
And
people were on the street.
It's made band instruments cool with
yeah,
kids.
That's true.
More importantly,
that's true.
You know, everybody,
right.
When I was a kid, they wanted to play guitar
yeah,
like you.
Yeah, play guitar.
And nobody
right.
played saxophone and trumpet.
Right. Yeah, but now it's cool.
Now it's cool to play trombone, especially.
Yeah.
You know, wind instruments are suddenly very cool.
Yes.
It's a good thing.
That is a good thing. So have. Have you checked in with Paul in the last? This is like
well,
this was 35 years ago.
Yeah, I didn't see Paul much after I made the film uh-huh. because I got on with
you,
my
yeah,
life.
Yeah, you were moving on. Yeah,
he was his lifestyle that you see depicted in the film. He gets in his car. He goes all around the country doing these gigs.
Yeah,
he hauls his own sound gear. Amazing lifestyle.
Yeah.
So, I was out of touch with him. And then in the DVD era,
uh-huh.
I decided I should, and I guess I was coming up on an anniversary of the film.
Uh-huh.
And I thought it would be great if Paul on his gigs, he had DVDs of this film that he
oh,
could
that's
sell.
That's a great idea.
In addition
yeah.
to his CDs.
Yeah, right.
So that motivated me to make the, do a new transfer from
uh-huh.
film
uh-huh.
and correct that toast shot.
Okay, right.
And,
flip that over. Yeah.
Make a DVD. And you had recommended that Blues Archive.
Right, in Mississippi.
Mississippi. So I, that was another thing. I thought,
University of
send...
Mississippi Blues Archive. It'd
I
be
did
a
that.
Perfect thing. Oh, wonderful.
That's exactly what you recommended.
Great, wonderful.
So I made the DVD and got in touch with Paul.
Oh, great.
And we met at Zip's Diner in Connecticut. Perfect
okay.
Paul place to meet.
Great.
And this might have been about 10 years ago.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Something like that. And he was the same old Paul.
Same as in the film.
Same as in the film. We had a great time laughing
ah,
and sitting
great.
There. And then he said, why don't you come over to my house and we'll listen to some records.
Great.
So we did. Went to his house and he was renting a space in a house in southern Rhode Island.
Uh-huh.
And I looked around and I thought, this is amazing. It's exactly the same.
Wow.
He's playing music on the road, playing country blues. He's got his record collection in his little house. Nothing had changed.
Wow.
But, I mean, in a beautiful way. You know, we get so obsessed with forward motion in
yes.
our careers. And
yes.
I got to
yep.
do this. I got to
sell
thing,
that
and get
thing.
One of those. And then I got to move up to that level. And I got to
yeah.
advance to this level.
Yeah.
Paul, he was still doing the same thing so beautifully.
Wow, that's
it
great.
It blew me away.
That's great.
So if you see the film... It's not much different from what Paul was doing 25 years later.
Wow.
He was just 25 years older.
Wow. That's great.
So he was doing great.
That's great. A couple of years ago... Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, maybe this is what you're going to say.
Well, a couple of years ago, Roy Bookbinder, who is a friend of Paul's, came to Bloomington. And I mentioned the film to him. That was before it was on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
And he was definitely familiar with the film and echoed... The same thing you're describing that Paul basically is kind of like, he said, well, you saw the film, that's kind of what Paul's doing now. You know, and this was only a couple of years ago, so, yeah.
Yeah. Well, sadly, in 2014, he suffered a stroke.
Yeah, I heard about that, and I looked up, and he was inducted into the Rhode Island Music Hall of Fame
yep.
around that same time, so
yeah.
I'm really glad he got that recognition.
Yeah.
As a bit of a diversion, why has Providence, Rhode Island been such a great music scene? I once saw a picture of T-Bone Walker, you know, the great Texas electric guitar player, playing at some place in Providence. But what's your... why Providence?
I don't have an explanation except
okay.
that it just is.
Uh-huh.
And that there's a kind of... For a while, there was a kinship between Providence and Austin because of the band Room Full of Blues.
Yes.
And...
The Fabulous Thunderbirds.
Yes.
And because... Duke and Preston Hubbard.
Preston Hubbard, right.
Yes, and Fran Christina.
Exactly.
Who was with Asleep at the Wheel and the T-Birds.
Right.
Yeah,
there was like a pipeline
between
Providence and Austin.
That was always my impression. Yeah.
So I think that contributed to it.
Okay.
And I have no other explanation. Other than that, there were always good bands in Providence, like Roomful of Blues.
Yeah,
Was Paul Murphy still playing
Paul
when
Murphy.
You were there?
Yeah, great guitar
Groove Masters.
Yeah, he was playing with James...
James Montgomery?
Yes, James Montgomery Band. Yeah.
It just always was like a great city in between other great cities.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
has always had a good music scene,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, it's so interesting to me.
Yeah.
It was great to see Paul. I think I saw him at a place around that time. What's the name of the place you mentioned that has Pelham in the title?
One Pelham East. That's Newport.
That's Newport. I think I saw him there.
It's still there.
Okay, it's still going. Yeah. Okay. And I feel like I saw him one other place down there. I say down there because I lived in Providence and Newport seemed very far away. I think it's all of 40
minutes. I think it's
miles.
About 40 minutes.
Yeah, I know. That's a long way in Providence. One serendipitous social media thing happened today, actually, where it literally happened today, where Roy Bookbinder is suddenly on Facebook and I started following him. And today he shared the YouTube link to the film, Something's Gotta Be Arranged.
Wow.
And so then the wonderful thing is people commented and they mentioned that Paul has good days and bad days.
Yeah.
But he's still on this side of the Great Divide, I think, which is great.
Yeah, I saw him 2 years ago.
You did? Okay.
Yep, he's living with a good friend of his in Providence.
Great.
And she's terrific and she's taking care of him. And it's very important to her and to Paul to have musicians dropping in to play with him.
Oh, great.
And so a couple of years ago... I started messing around with ukulele and then tenor guitar.
Great.
So I brought my tenor guitar down there.
Ah, he must have been intrigued.
And he and I, he liked seeing that.
Yeah.
And when we had this little arrangement, our banjo player doubled. He had a tenor guitar that he would switch between banjo and guitar.
Uh-huh.
So Paul was familiar with it from those days. So I went down and strummed a few chords with him, and it was a lot of fun.
Cool, that's great.
Yeah, I haven't been down since.
Oh, that's great.
I'm overdue.
You could see him so recently.
See him
that's
again.
Wonderful.
Yeah, that was 2016, I think. I saw.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Great. It's not like a field recording in the sense that a lot of the field recordings would just kind of let a camera roll, you know?
Yeah.
This is beautifully edited, and it's a wonderful
It's not
piece.
Terribly complex. It's very simple. You know,
right.
Paul sings a tune.
Yeah.
Then you see a bit of his life that kind of is echoed by the song.
Yes.
And then you hear another song, and then you see another slice of life that's kind of echoed in the song.
Yes.
I was trying to make a connection between the songs he sings and the life he's leading.
Yes. And then we go to Chicago.
Now we go to Chicago.
Yeah.
And in there you hear his history, how he came
yeah.
up, the music he listened to, how he got turned on to guitar.
Yeah.
That's fascinating,
it
too.
It is really fascinating. Is there anything else you'd like to mention about this film and, you know, having it out there in the world for 35 years?
I'm so thrilled people are seeing it because it sat on a shelf. I entered it in a couple of festivals locally,
mm-hmm.
but then there was no place for it to go. You know,
right.
I was just at this film conference here at IU,
right.
and someone mentioned, you know, you spend all this time, you make a film, you're done with the film, but you're only half done. Because now you got to put it somewhere.
You
got to promote it. It's got to go places.
Yeah.
So it's a whole new job when you're an independent person just making your own work.
Mm-hmm.
Making the work is half the job. Now you got to do something with it.
Right.
So I didn't. But when YouTube came along, it's great.
It's a great fit for
YouTube. Get it out there.
Yeah.
And it's out there. People see it. They comment on it.
And the comments on it are wonderful. People, the comments about Paul and about the film. And it's wonderful. It's a wonderful connection. It's a way in which the YouTube age is kind of a positive thing to have people to see this film that otherwise wouldn't see it.
Right.
And to kind of comment and participate in their own way. I think it's wonderful.
Someone did say, you know, you should have filmed some more with Paul, like an update, like where is he now?
Oh, okay.
But as Roy Bookbinder has pointed out, there's no need.
That's kind of...
What you see in the film is the lifestyle that Paul has led since then.
Wow.
You know, different cars.
Yeah.
Different
tunes. Different Dodges.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Different.
Yeah, he has 11 albums, even more albums out now.
Yeah, more. He's got 10 or 12 records out.
Yeah.
And he's living that same lifestyle.
Wow.
It's pretty amazing.
That's great. thank you for coming in and being a part of WFHB. We always want to know, like, what are Bloomington's a wonderful place. What's your connection to Bloomington?
Well, my wife's father was an Indiana University professor for many, many years in mathematics and then computer science and then informatics. So I visited Bloomington.
Oh, so you were
starting when I got married in 1992. Twice a year, we're here in the winter and the summer. Great. And I love Bloomington.
It's a great town.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of music and
there's a lot of espresso.
A lot of espresso, exactly. What other filmmakers, especially filmmakers who do music, have you seen or are you interested in? Who else is kind of out there right now?
Well, at the time at RISD, our film professor showed us the work of Les Blank.
Les Blank, who did the Lightnin' Hopkins films, if I'm not mistaken. Yes. Wonderful pieces.
And Les Blank came to RISD.
Oh, wow.
And spoke to our class, and he showed a rough cut. The film is called Burden of Dreams.
Burden of Dreams.
It's a documentary about the making of Fitzcarraldo.
Right, right.
And he showed us a rough cut of that.
Wow.
And then he looked at our stuff.
Oh, really?
He was a visiting critic.
Oh, wow. So you actually screened your works for him.
This was before I started making my film.
Okay.
So all I did was sit and talk to him.
Uh-huh.
I said, well, I think I might make a thing about a blues singer.
Great.
And he thought that was a terrific idea.
Yeah, yeah.
So he was an early influence because we saw his films and he came and I got to meet him and speak to him.
Oh, that's cool. Cool.
But recently there have been some quite good films about musicians.
Oh, yeah. What are some that come to mind?
Two recent films come to mind that I love as documentaries about musicians that I think are among the best documentaries about musicians you'll see.
Okay, actually, what are they?
One is Beware of Mr. Baker.
Ah, Ginger Baker.
Correct.
Great.
Terrific.
Okay.
And then there's a film about Keith Richards.
Ah.
Called Under the Influence. Yeah, Keith Richards, Under the Influence. Both fantastic documentaries about musicians.
Okay, great.
In my opinion.
Great. Last question, what are you going to do? What are you going to do next? What's next in your either any intersection of film or music, music or film? You're playing with the band in Somerville, but what kind of film or film music project would you like to do?
Well, there's a wonderful drummer in New Orleans. He's the king of Tremé.
Ah,
Shannon Powell.
Oh, okay. Someone mentioned him. Yeah, someone mentioned him.
I've heard him interviewed on NPR.
Okay.
He's a very smart and very funny man and a fabulous drummer.
Uh-huh.
And so that's a fantasy project.
Like, great.
To go down in New Orleans. Wouldn't that be cool?
That would be cool.
To make a film about Shannon Powell.
That would be really cool.
Because he's also at an intersection. Mm. He touches on all kinds of music. And when I heard him on NPR, just for a few minutes, he so beautifully explained the basic rhythm that powers New Orleans and rock and roll music.
Wow.
And
wow.
I can't reproduce that.
Wow.
You have to go find that.
Okay, we'll look for
listen
that.
Listen to that.
Okay.
But if you listen to it, you'll say to yourself, I want to make a film about him because he's a smart and funny and talented man.
A great subject.
So that's something in the back of my head.
That's
I would love
a great
to do.
One. That's a great
I don't know if I'll ever get around to that. I'm still working.
Working, yes.
I'm still working.
Well, you do great work on a lot of stuff. Thank you so much. It's been fabulous. Jeff Adams,
Thank you so much.
The filmmaker of the 35th anniversary, came out in 1983, widely available on YouTube, easily available on YouTube
easily
now,
available.
Starring Paul Jeremiah and Blind John Davis, Something Gotta Be Arranged. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason. I should make a film about you.
Yeah.